Well, in this part of Focus 580, we welcome back to the program a fellow who's been with us a few times here on the show, Rick Kaplan, who is former president of CNN USA. He's an adjunct professor of journalism at U of I, and now a couple times a year he's here and has been doing this for quite a few years, spends a week working with journalism students. He's been in the news business for a while. He worked for CBS back in the days when Walter Cronkite was still doing the news. Then he spent quite a few years at ABC and worked on all of their flagship programs, including World News Tonight and Nightline. In August of 1997, he went to work for CNN and was there until recently when they parted company. And we're pleased to have him here. And when he's here, we talk about media and news coverage. And I'm sure that we'll spend quite a bit of time here this morning talking about the election, how it was covered.
You think so?
You remember that election?
Sure.
The election of 2000?
It's still on, isn't it?
As far as I know. So questions are certainly welcome here. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much.
Oh, I'm sorry. Whoever scheduled me, I have classes every hour. And, you know, it's really funny because on paper it works out fine. You have class from 10 to 11, then you do an interview from 11 to 12. But
there's this travel time. Yeah,
you're still
over there in the in Gregory Hall where we used to be, and
right.
Now we're here in the new building and— Well, I was thinking that you might even just be next door in the TV
in
teaching
the Richmond Center,
in the
right.
Richmond Center. But all right. Anyway, well,
but I'm here.
Glad to be here.
So I'm glad to be here.
So I was taking a look at some things having to do with election coverage, and I wanted to ask you, a fellow at Brookings, Stephen Hess, mm-hmm. has been apparently throughout the campaign been looking at how the major networks, the over-the-air networks, ABC, CBS, NBC, covered it. And he has periodically been—
At CNN, we would call those the broadcast
the
networks,
broadcast
not the major networks.
Pardon me. The broadcast networks, the over-the-air broadcast networks. Fair point. How they covered it. And he, his last report here it was up on the Brookings site. He took a look at the presidential campaign coverage on the over-the-air networks since Labor Day. And here's what he found. First of all, that on the three major shows, Peter Jennings, Dan Rather, and Tom Brokaw, they had the fewest minutes of campaign news in their history, which is something he said he hadn't expected. The other thing that he found was that sound bites now are the average length of candidate sound bites on the evening news is now 7 seconds, which is another all-time low. And that much of the news that they reported was negative, was looking at negative aspects of the campaign. Do you expect we're just going to get worse and worse?
Well, no, I mean, that's ridiculous. You know, it's embarrassing, that report. It really is. I think people have started to lose their way a bit. And it's sad. It really is. Mm. I think that, look, my position prior and current is simply that the more news there is, we'll just look at it realistically for a minute. The more news there is on an entertainment network, the more news there is in the world, the less money an entertainment network makes. In fact, the more news there is, the more money they lose. The more news there is, the more money cable news makes. So who's in a business? I mean, it's like the entertainment networks are kind of like Amazon.com. You know, the more books they sell, the more money they lose. Mm. So at some point, I assume Amazon sells all the books and runs out of money. But I think that's really embarrassing, and I think Peter and Dan would be most embarrassed by it. On the other hand, they're also most responsible for it because you start to get into a situation where in order to attract more viewers, you think, well, their attention spans are shorter, and you start to degrade your own coverage, and I think that's a huge mistake. Your core audience, those people who will watch you whether there's a lot of news or not, they really want the news, and they don't want to be talked down to, and they don't want to be twisted, and they don't want to be pushed and pulled and all the rest. They just want, you know, kind of give me the news, I'll make up my mind. And they're not interested in 7-second sound bites. And in a campaign like this one, they sure would have wanted more coverage, not less. If you look, what's going to be more condemning if he went the extra step would mm-hmm. not be that there was less campaign coverage on than ever before. It would be what replaced it. Because if what replaced it was the fact that we had extraordinary violence on the West Bank and in the Middle East, I mean, I don't know how many presidential campaigns have had that kind of an amazing story that would dominate news as well at the same time? I don't know the answer to that. But if what replaced it was a bunch of Eye on Americas and American agendas and a bunch of sappy stuff that they think somehow sucks in younger viewers as if that should be a priority, then, you know, it's fine on them.
Yeah. I guess one thing I could say about the study is that it looked at another issue where news media has been heavily criticized, and that is, are we looking at strategy, what's often called the horse race, or are we looking at issues? And once again, it seems like mostly what they spent their time talking about was the horse race.
Well, if you're talking about the evening news, I think most of the time they should spend on the horse race and some time devoted to to issues. This wouldn't be popular programming, but I think the magazines and specials should devote more time to the issues. You know, there's a place to turn for certain kinds of news. You don't turn to the Sunday magazine for the horse race. You turn to the Sunday magazine for the issues. You don't turn to the front page of a newspaper for the issues, although some issue stories start there. You have to go inside for the bulk of it. I mean, it's just where you tune. I think there has to be a good, healthy mix of both. And this was a case where, in all the polling, it was very clear that people cared about the issues because they didn't particularly care for either of the guys.
Yeah. The other – well, another thing that's interesting is that apparently when you look at the over-the-air broadcast networks and where they're really spending most time talking about the candidates, that coverage seems to have really shifted to the morning – magazines, and now they have these primetime vehicles that they're using, but programs like 2020 and the 60 Minutes, those shows, they're not doing it either. If anybody's doing it, it's
Good Morning America.
It's Good Morning America and the Today Show.
And they're not doing it in a particularly serious way. It's not a great state of affairs. But I'll tell you, this is a real interim period for news and for television in general. As we approach kind of the era where there's a convergence of the web and television and radio and print, and it, you know, it all starts to kind of converge on your video unit at home, which right now is made up of a separate television and computer screen. At some point soon it will be merged. You're going to be able to, I think, access far more information. You're going to be kind of able to learn much more, not be victimized as it is by little tiny sound bites and shallowness. I think that the world of information is going to change quite radically. You know, the web itself, people go to the web for much more content, much more substance. We used to worry, were people reading anymore? Well, if you're going to go to the web, you're reading. I mean, because there's not a whole lot else to do on the web but read. And I think you're going to find that in this next generation of information, which may be here within 5 years, you're going to find, I think, that in enhanced television and what is offered on your video unit, you're going to be able to do a much better job of being informed and learning about the substance. And networks are going to have to give you the option of going the heavy substantive route, or you're not going to go to their website or their station or their whatever it'll be called.
Well, Art, do you think that CBS, NBC, ABC are going to continue to do nightly newscasts? Will some point come?
I'm not sure
say
the future.
Anymore?
I'm really not sure. Look, I think the future for newspapers. Now, get to TV quickly. Mm-hmm. I think the future for newspapers is that there's no such thing anymore as the morning and evening editions. I think newspapers are alive. I think you'll go, and when you want to download your newspaper or read your newspaper, you'll get the up to the minute newspaper with reporters constantly updating their stories on it. I think when you want the news, you're going to get the up-to-the-minute news. Right now, you know, you kind of get Dan Rather or Peter Jennings or Tom Brokaw live at 5:30 here. And if you're on the West Coast, you get him live on tape. It's a three-hour-old show. In the future, you're going to be getting the news from ABC News and CBS News and NBC News up to the minute. Now, maybe there won't be a Dan Rather to deliver it. Maybe it won't be delivered in such a way. But I think it's going to matter that you get it up to the minute. And is it – so I don't know what the form of those newscasts is going to be. It's actually one of the things I intend to study from in the near future. But I think you're going to access information differently. And I don't think you're going to see the three broadcast networks, all of them at least, involved in news.
Our guest this morning, Rick Kaplan. He's former president, CNN USA. He's also adjunct professor of journalism, University of Illinois. A couple of times a year, he spends a week here working with students, and he's usually here on the show when he's here.
Always here on the show.
Well, actually, yeah. It has. I think
it's like
for
10
last
years.
Really? It's been that long?
Oh, it's every... I mean, I've been doing teaching for 8 years and a professor for three. And it starts from the second year my daughter was a student here. And she's 25. I mean, it's 10 years, close to 10 years.
Okay. Well, we always...
You look the same.
I'm here.
Beard's
oh, no.
gotten a little no, whiter, grayer. But you look the same.
Grayer. Well, we got a caller here. Others are welcome. 333-WILL, toll free, 800-222-WILL. Caller here in Freeport, line four. Hello.
Well, I got kind of two general statements to make. First of all, I read years ago that Walter Cronkite was closely tied up with the CIA, sort of a de facto agent of them, working with them. And also, more recently, Dan Rather, you know, the Texan broadcaster on CBS in the evening news, you know, he was sent over to Afghanistan while the Afghan Muslim rebels were fighting the Soviet forces, and it said that he... they demonstrated to him how they took care of Russian prisoners. They shot one in front of him. And, I mean, that's getting pretty close to the war situation, I'd say. And your general, and during the Gulf War, you had that censorship of media by the military. The media just kind of went along with that, correct?
I have no idea. I mean, having worked with Walter and worked with Dan, I don't know what to say to you about those first two comments. But as for the last comment, there was censorship in a war. In a war, there is always censorship by the military that you're kind of the guest of, if you will. And what you do and what we did, and I was at ABC at the time, is you just tell people that this report has been handled by American military censors, and if a piece of video was censored out, you sometimes put up a blank black screen and just say censored by American military censors. So you tell people when you're in that situation. You'll notice that when reporting came out of Baghdad, where it was not only heavily censored but most often they sent minders with you, so you didn't have a private moment. You would come clean on that with your viewers and your listeners as well, saying that I was, you know, I'm here. I was taken here by Iraqi minders who have also censored my reporting, and I'm only able to tell you this. And at least then people know to be questioning about what they're hearing.
Oh, well, I understand that Iraq, Saddam Hussein, picked up TV reports from the United States.
Oh, absolutely. They all watch CNN, in fact.
CNN, yeah.
The first time I met Saddam Hussein, I was working for ABC, and I walked in, and I won't go through the rigmarole you have to go through to see him, and he came up to me, and I'm thinking, oh, God, what is he going to say? Or, you know, because he's it's not that he's intimidating, but you do have certain misgivings when you meet him. And he looked at me and said, did I know Bobby Batista? That's his first question. And I said, you mean the CNN anchor woman? And he said, yes. I said, no, actually, I work at ABC. I don't know her. He says, I watch her every day. So, you know.
Well, it seems to me that the media is kind of leading us in a situation of mind control. You know, there's sort of worldwide coverage of all events, you know, now and everything. I mean, the media could be used for mind control, I say.
I hope not.
Well, thanks for the comment. We got others certainly have the option to call. If you have questions, comments, you want to talk to our guest, Rick Kaplan, you can give us a call. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. The networks have, CNN included, have come under some criticism for exit polling.
Justifiable criticism.
And all this business of calling what happened in Florida, first calling it for Gore, then calling it for Bush, then saying, we don't know. And now I think we're talking about some people in Congress are talking about having hearings. Will this change anything? What, next time around, four
I hope
years?
It'll change. My own personal rule, I'm not about to sit here and tell you that, well, if I had been at the controls at CNN that night, that they wouldn't have made a wrong call. I'm not telling you that at all. But I am telling you that it was always a policy of mine. I didn't like to call races before all the polls in the state are closed, even when it was clear that the panhandle wouldn't change the vote if that was the case. I still didn't want to call it because while there is no evidence that an early call in a race changes the number of people who show up at the polls, and quite frankly, there's an enormous amount of evidence that it doesn't. But even with that said, I just didn't want to call a race till all the polls in the state have closed. And
that's another thing I wanted to ask you about, because I had thought that some years back the networks had all, because there was criticism of that, they had all said, okay, we're not going to do that anymore. And this time around is the first time that I remember in some time them calling states before the polls had closed.
Well, actually, they had always closed. I mean, if Florida was too close to call to start with, then they wouldn't have called it and you would never have known it. Yeah. Or if it was such a runaway as it had been in a number of other elections, then they would have called it and you just wouldn't have known it. And very few other states, like I think Indiana is also a split time zone, perhaps during election times. Yeah. But it's split in such a way that less than 80% of the polls would be closed when the first time zone came. So you couldn't call Indiana till all the, you know, you'd have to really wait until the central time zone had cleared for the poll closings, because not enough polls closed in the eastern time zone. So there's very few states that rule actually impacts on. But Florida was one of them. But it's a mistake. It's a terrible mistake. And somebody said something very interesting to me. If the Palm Beach voters, and I am not, by the way, I am opposed to a revote. I said to somebody, I've read the Constitution numerous times and never found the word mulligan anywhere in the Constitution. So I'm not for a revote or anything like that. And I think that when the recount's done, and I think Governor Bush is going to be ahead, that Gore ought to just say, congratulations, President Bush, President-elect Bush, and I'm going to be here to support you. That's the right thing to do, I think. However, as somebody said, well, what happens if the Palm Beach voters really did kind of screw up? The fact is, what it would have meant was that the early poll was right, the early call was right. Because what an early call can't make up for is a whole mess of voters making a mistake or thinking they're voting for Gore and really voting for someone else and voiding their ballots. But with all that said and done, the simple fact is this. You don't call a race till all the polls are closed. And I don't know what information the voter service had handed out to all the networks. Everyone has the same numbers. But I would bet you there had to be an error in that, because even in the wild, even with the Palm Beach voters not making the errors they made, or even if whether they did or didn't make errors, it's still too close a race to call. And it has been my experience, because these guys who call the races, they would rather die than make a mistake. Mm-hmm. And so they were misled for one reason or another. And I would bet that, and I would hope it would come out, that when the numbers are shown to people, that there either is an enormous error in the voter survey. But I think it'll make the networks far more wary. You know, you can't get, if the only thing a network has is the trust it has with its public, and you hurt that, which they have done clearly with this election and with their reporting of it, they're going to take great pains to make sure they don't get near the line next time. But I also hope that Americans understand out of this election that when somebody says your vote counts, it's not just rhetoric. Yeah. Your vote counts.
Yeah. All right. Let's go to next caller in line, which would be line number two. We have someone in southeastern Illinois. Hello.
Yes, I don't want to get into the election business, except I would say, without detailing it, there were three opportunities for the Democrat Party to clear up the point, any confusing ballot in that Palm Beach area. If nothing else, they could have mounted an educational campaign at the end, saying, vote punch hole three.
No, he's exactly right, and in fact, the ballot was approved by an election commissioner who was a Democrat.
Yeah, that's what I say. They had three opportunities, and that kind of campaign is often done in the case of a referendum, which is worded in such a way that it's confusing, and you think you're voting against it, you vote no, and you're really voting for it. They'll have an education blitz that will say, you know, you want to vote yes on this if you're against it and that sort of thing. But what I wanted to ask you about was the handling of stories where and I think this is particularly true, I don't know about the printed, but the electronic media, handling a story where they can't really tell the story. And there have been two examples in the last few years. One was Clinton and Monica, where they sort of jumped around that story and didn't really tell you what it was until finally you kind of got in bits and pieces that it was fellatio, I mean, which they could have reported right off if they had wanted to. I mean, later you got something about a cigar being involved, but I mean, basically, that was it. But they reported the story, but you didn't really know what the story was because they weren't reporting the story. The second one is with George W. Bush, where the story came out during the campaign that he had used, I don't know how they phrased it, bad language in front of an open mic. Well, they didn't say what the bad language was, so you didn't know whether it was a vulgarism, a profanity, an obscenity, or what it was. I mean, it could have gone anywhere from something involving feces to a GDMF. And oftentimes in a case like that, you tend to think of the worst words you know and think that's what was said. Well, it finally came out. I heard it from somewhere that what he had done was refer to some journalist as a major league rectal orifice. He used a short word, two-syllable word for the last two words that I used, but in other words, he'd used a vulgarism. But what do you do? What was your policy in reporting stories where did you get cutesy and sort of skirt around them, or did you come out with some kind of definite language that let people know what really had occurred? Or
we had long conversations about what language was allowable and what language was not, and arrived at an acceptable and completely descriptive solution so that you knew what we were talking about, and people were extraordinarily uncomfortable. I mean, there was an enormous discussion, and we finally agreed that we could use, you know, I was uncomfortable then, and I'm uncomfortable now, and I don't know if this word's allowed on the station or not, but in discussing a certain male organ, and there was a debate that went on forever about whether we could say that word. And it's one of the things I think Americans and journalists and American journalists and everybody else just got kind of really disgusted with, because what we did is we cruded up the airwaves. We made the dialogue and the language coarser and not more pleasant. And it was not fun to report it, and it was not fun to deal with it. And it was not fun, I'm sure, to listen to it. And it was pretty disgusting. And I think in some ways, clearly the president is to blame for this, and clearly the House impeachment managers are to blame for coarsening the language as well, because I don't think there's any reason they have to dump like they did what they did.
The big example was President Clinton and Monica Lewinsky, but I mean, even in a little story like George W. Bush said in front of an open mic that was bad language, you know, I mean...
Well, I saw that reported, and that was pretty well described.
Was it?
Yeah.
Well, I evidently missed that, so first few times that I heard it, it was not really specified.
Well, and I actually think that in the reports that I heard that we had from NPR, they played it, and it was, you had to listen closely, but you could hear what he said. I don't even think we bleeped it.
See,
is that so?
I'd go the extra yard to say to you, and so? I mean, this is, you know, how many, do you know anybody who has never used that word to describe someone they don't like? If you do, he's probably already sitting on the Supreme Court. But
I just wondered, because it is evidently I didn't hear the NPR broadcast of it. So, but I mean, the what I heard, and it is a problem. But I think a lot of times you can sort of move it into scholarly language that will get the idea across. It might send people scurrying to their dictionaries, but I mean. It doesn't have to be necessarily crude, but Okay, thank you.
All right, well, let's go on. We got another caller here in Northern Illinois, line number 3.
Yes, I was interested in where you always hear the liberal media. But I was surprised how close the vote was, especially that Gore won the popular vote, because especially the last 2 weeks, what I thought I saw a lot of is, oh, it's too close to call, but if Gore loses, it's because of, like, Nader or something like that. And that other places talked about how inevitable that's what the Bush people kept trying to build. It was inevitable. And I thought that slanted everything, because you could see George Stephanopoulos going on about, well, if Gore lost. And even Slate magazine, Michael Kingsley, had an article about why, you know, who should be blamed. And headlines would be, Gore has more money, which is really a distortion, because you have to read the second paragraph to see that the Republicans had, you know, $25 million more. And I noticed that you just said, you know, once the ballots are in on Friday and they come up with something, Gore should really think about, you know, saying that he lost. And you're automatically assuming that all those ballots are going to be military and they're going to be for Bush. And I've noticed that a lot. Would you comment on the media slant?
Well, why don't I just comment on what I said, which is that I'm saying what I said because the governor has a lead now, slight though it be. And if I look at the way, and this is my own sample precinct, if you will, key precinct. If I look at the way absentee and overseas ballots came in 4 years ago, Bob Dole won, I think, 65% of those ballots in a race where he got creamed in Florida generally. And historically, those ballots are very strongly Republican. Moreover, if you listen to one of the first compromises offered up by James Baker, it was, well, why don't we just count those overseas ballots and whatever it turns out to be, that it's what it turns out to be. And I thought the Gore people almost had a coronary over that. So you are the general wisdom is that the governor, I mean, if Gore can't get a large enough plurality out of the machine and hand votes, then it's over.
Yeah, and I agree with that. It's just that when the, you know, like the Bush people was, oh, no, you know, like Bush might win in the general election, you know, win all the votes in the general election.
Well, the general, the wisdom was that one could win electoral, one could win popular, but it was the opposite way. It was actually the conventional wisdom that Gore would win the electoral vote and Bush would win the popular vote, and it turned out to be the opposite.
Right, but what the, in general, it doesn't make any difference whether it was Andy Shaw in Chicago or any place. It was always, you know, the Bush people are concerned. Not, I don't think anybody ever said Gore might win the popular vote. It's as if Gore winning is automatically, you know, no matter how they look, they're not saying how many people in Israel voted. And you didn't even bother to mention that. You didn't mention that there was a salary increase for the enlisted men. And I agree with you. You know, you're going with what the odds are. But those last 2 weeks, there was always, it's too close to call, but if Gore loses, it's too close to call.
It's just refreshing to hear somebody call and talk about the conservative biased media. So it's great to hear your call.
Okay. And all right. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, let me ask a slightly different question, but it's sort of the same question. I think that some Democrats were looking at the coverage and were saying that the news media was spending more time looking at what Mr. Gore said and pointing out misstatements than they did look at what Mr. Bush said and pointing out misstatements, or looking at what his record was in Texas. What do you think about
Well,
the
coverage? You know, Bush pretty much kept a script. So there wasn't much to say about the governor because he kept saying pretty much the same thing. And Gore made a whole mess of misstatements. So the vice president left himself open for that. When he picked at Governor Bush for something he said, which was saying basically that Social Security was not a federal program. Well, that's, of course, not what the governor said. And, you know, it's a little tough. And journalists don't want to play that kind of silly game. If politicians want to go ahead and put commercials on the air and sit there and say, and this candidate voted against orphans and against old people and against sick people and wanted everyone to die, and, you know, logic should tell you it's probably not exactly what this guy voted for or this woman voted for. I mean, if they want to go ahead and twist things that way, that's fine. But we don't generally want to play that game. The fact is, Bush went around the country with a very narrow campaign. He had his issue or his set of issues and his beliefs, and he did what he did. And you know, Gore was kind of everything and all over and left himself open to make mistakes and made a few. And, look, in the end, both sides are probably unhappy with the way they were covered, but the election is a toss-up, and life is life.
All right. Let's see. Where are we going next? I've got a car phone. Let's do that. Line three.
Hey.
Hello.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Morning, guys.
Morning.
I have a car phone. It's not really a question. It's just wanting to know what your comments would be. I think it's time now for media reporters to become licensed and to be held accountable for the content that they release. And I'd like to know what you think about that and how close is the industry to having a state license in order for a person to be employed by a TV station, radio station, or newspaper, or even conduct news on the Internet or a web page.
Well, I'm totally opposed to licensing journalists. It's a First Amendment right, And I wouldn't like to see the government get into licensing so that only certain people are eligible for the benefits of freedom of the press. On the other hand, if you don't think journalists are accountable for what they say, then I don't know where you're living. Because the truth of the matter is journalists are totally accountable for what they say. And if you get a journalist who says the wrong things or makes mistakes or a network that does the wrong thing or makes mistakes, you're going to find people tune out of that network or tune out of that website. There's a whole bunch of people who were the taste du jour for a long, long time, and after they started making enough mistakes, you don't hear about their websites or their names anymore.
I think people who are boosters of the Internet would be horrified with the idea that you'd have to have a license before you could have a website. I mean,
yeah.
That's sort of one of the beauties of the Internet, that
no,
you
that's
don't.
Exactly right. And if anything needs a little reason, it would be the Internet right now.
All right. Well, we have several other callers. I hope that responds to the question of the caller. Let's go to Belgium, line number one. Hello.
Hello. It seems though many of your people who are calling in making comments today are echoing a thing that I've talked to you several times before, sir, on this show. Media seems to make their own media. I've said it to you many, many times, at least twice I've called in, and that I pointed out exactly these people say. You report the news in a way that really influences the news, whether it's biased one way or the other. With the Simpson case, when John Glenn went into space, we totally forgot about a horrible hurricane. Last summer, or summer before last, it was Monica. Now it's the election. You know, the talking heads just continue to do this same thing, beat us to death with these facts that they're really not even sure of themselves. But yet they make an impression and they cause a difference. And this is an example. This election is exactly an example of what's happened. The last caller, where I don't think it should be licensed, but there should be a greater deal of accountability than what there is, for sure. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, I guess the criticism, and it's a longstanding criticism, is that that the news media have too much power to set the agenda. And that we pick out, and any given day, there may be 10 or 20 or 30 things that maybe should have coverage, but we pick one or two, and we obsess about those things until we get tired of them, and then we pick something else, and we obsess about those things. And maybe they aren't the most important things.
But that's pretty much the nature of the American public. And the fact of the matter is Americans are much more interested in the top lead stories of the day, if you will. And that's what they spend their time doing. Americans generally get what they want. That's why Beverly Hillbillies was on for a long time and Green Acres and all the rest of that. And that's when people start criticizing, you know, network television. It's kind of like, you know, you have the ultimate control. Turn it off. Change the channel. Stop listening to that anchorman. Stop listening to that network. That's how people vote.
All right. We got about 10 minutes left with Rick Kaplan, Former president of CNN USA, he's here visiting the campus as he has now for a number of years, a couple of times during the year when the students are here. He comes and works with journalism students, and then he always comes and talks with us about news media. Your questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. To Chicago, line number four. Hello.
Hi there. Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Kaplan, first, thanks for taking some time out to take some questions.
Good morning.
A couple of two points, and they're not related, but feel free to comment on them. First, I'm a little concerned, a lot concerned. I think increasingly a lot of the most important issues of the day seem to be requiring increased, I don't know, technical knowledge or expertise to really understand them. And I think frequently, given the shorter amount of time, especially on commercial radio, commercial television, to cover those things, those aren't covered. Just a couple of examples, I think, of things that have come up in the last couple of weeks. Legal issues, defining what it means to have an arbitrary and capricious standard of review. Economics issues, whenever the unemployment rate is discussed and there's no discussion of what numbers are left out, like a natural rate of unemployment, maybe that isn't explained very readily, so people get these numbers, don't know how to deal with this. Things with polling numbers and the methodology of the poll is not explained very much. I think with the exception of, well, frankly, other than maybe the News Hour with Jim Lehrer, and I think on stations like NPR, we have regular reporters working a regular beat, and the extra time it takes to explain those background things. I think a lot of those issues are glossed over, and I think that the even in the short amount of time they've got in the 7-second soundbite, like you were discussing, even that time it does more harm than good, because I think those background issues are so important. So I don't know. It seems to me that reporters are going to have increased technical knowledge to be able to explain these things to
I think that's right. I think that you get into a situation now, for instance, just to pick up on one of the points you had mentioned, you have numbers come out and they deal with salary inflation, and the government publishes its numbers and say, oh, look at this, there was no salary inflation last year. Well, an economics reporter or a business reporter ought to know that in the government's computation of that number, they don't include stock options and bonuses. And if you were a business reporter, you'd know that a major part of everyone's compensation, or a good deal of the executive compensation now in business, is stock options and bonuses. So, in fact, that flat inflation is probably even a double-digit inflation. So you're right. I mean, the expertise. I think you're going to see a difference. I think this is a real interim period for news and for television and for cable and for radio and for print. And I think we'll soon enter a far more disciplined and detailed world of information.
Maybe I could follow up just with a quick question on this, and then I'll throw my related, well, maybe not related comment in there as well, and you can comment on that as well. As someone who's training journalists, do you think a degree in journalism is the thing people should be procuring, or would a degree in economics or history or mathematics or statistics be a better background for these types of things? And the other comment, I'll just hang up and let you listen. If we're moving to an age where, like you said, increasingly it's going to be less turn on CBS and watch Dan Rather as my talking head, but to download my news, do you think that maybe the accountability or trustworthiness of these mass media outlets would go down? Now I turn on television, rightly or wrongly, I think that the public reaction is, well, there's Peter Jennings reading me the news. I'm holding him accountable. And I don't know, there's a face and a presence and a personality people link on to and either accept or reject, and they can kind of measure their...
Well, you've made fabulous points, actually.
Yeah. Okay, I'll hang up and listen to you.
What I tell my students, in fact, just before I got here, the last question I got in the class that I was in was about what to major in. And I said, well, I'm an economics political science major, and I actually don't think it's very important to major in journalism or communications. I say that knowing that people in the communication school here, who I adore and who do a fantastic job, are probably sticking pins in my dial right now. Fact is, you need to get an education, and as long as you buttress that degree with some good, solid instructional subjects, I fold my cards for a while. In terms of accountability. I have a real problem with the lack of accountability on the web. And like you say, it's kind of nameless, faceless. But what I think will happen as the web integrates and as it gets broader is that it won't necessarily be Peter Jennings anymore, but you will hold the ABC brand accountable, the CNN brand, the CBS brand, the whatever other brand you're tuning into accountable or you're going to. And I think you'll find that just like some websites have died a quick death because they lost their credibility, it may be a Peter Jennings in a webcast, and it may be all kind of digitally put together. I mean, there's a whole new world out there, and we haven't solved the problems of that kind of accountability, but certainly you're going to hold the brand accountable for its accuracy, and that might speak well for companies like CNN, ABC, NBC, and CBS, and the rest who you have some experience with and are in the best position to protect the accuracy and fairness of what they do.
All right, on to another caller. Urbana, this is line number 2.
This is the most callers we've ever had.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Hi, I have a bunch of things to say, but I'm not going to get them all in. With regard to the butterfly ballot, as my understanding is, and I think PBS did, or NPR did a pretty good job of reporting this, is that it doesn't meet the state law with regard to how the ballot should be set up.
I think, though, just pardon me for interrupting, but I think subsequently I've heard that the state election commission or somebody ruled on that and, in fact, ruled that it was legal.
The state election commission took a look at the ballot, and it's a democratically controlled group, and they approved it.
They said it was okay. So I guess that issue is off,
it's off the table.
Well, I think that the average person often doesn't pick up on what might be confusing to people. If you take a look at our own voting system here in Illinois and in Champaign County, there is a pencil that's attached to the balloting, the thing that holds the cards, and there's also a stylus. The pencil is attached on the right-hand side. Most people are right-handed. And if you work at a polling place, you'll find that throughout the day, no matter how many signs you put up or how many times you tell people, you will find people trying to vote with the pencil, and the pencil doesn't make any holes in the ballot. I worked at a polling place, and I've worked several times, and a lot of the times at the end of the day when we count the ballots, we don't count the votes, we just count the ballots, make sure we have the same number of applications as ballots for each color of ballot, etc. There's often somebody's ballot who doesn't have any holes punched in it at all. We had somebody who voted on his punched ballot with a pencil. I've had people of all ages get confused by this. Seems to be often some people who are elderly, but it's also I've also had younger people say, "How am I supposed to vote in here?" Even though there's stuff outside to help people. It still is confusing.
Yeah, I think it's going to be one of the outcomes of what's happened here, which is that they're going to have to improve the way we vote. They're going to have to, whether it's going to more different machines or working with some kind of online system. But I think that what we're discovering is that's exactly what you're finding, that some of these systems are either old, antiquated, too difficult, too problematic. Everyone should be able to vote without really... it shouldn't be brain surgery to cast a ballot.
Well, the other thing that we need is more and a variety of ages of election judges. People who often are willing to do this are often retired, and if you stay doing it for a long time, you can get to be quite elderly doing this. And it's a very, very long day, and although people get paid, it's still, as I said, a very long day, and it would help to have more people who are younger who would take the time off from work or take the time out of whatever else they're doing to help staff the polling places.
There's no question about that. And further, as I know you seem like someone who probably has, who does this, I mean, nobody is going to take that job for the money. So
right.
Whether they get paid or not, it's nominal.
Thanks.
All right, thank you. And let's see. We'll get at least one more person here. That will be another Urbana caller, line 3.
Hello.
Hello.
A slight correction on the... absentee balloting in the last Florida election. The margin was actually 5%, which is probably very low for most other states. And that's as reported by NPR this morning.
We're talking about...
Yes, your guest reported it at 65-35, wasn't that great a difference. So it's not quite as certain who will win on the absentee ballots as it might seem.
I think, though...
I was talking about the county, not the state. The statewide difference was 5%. The countywide difference there was 65%.
So I guess you're both right.
Possibly.
Okay.
Thank you.
Was there another point you wanted to make?
Well, one quick one would be that there are four counties which Bush supporters have requested recounts in and have been completed, giving minor additions, I believe, to the Bush total. So I don't see what's so exceptional about a recount of the other four counties that are in question now. I mean, recounts are a standard part of election procedure. One was requested exactly the same type in New Mexico by the Bush people.
We're just about the point where we're going to have to stop. I don't know. Is there any last thing you can say about that other than
the reason, you know, the feeling is that the place where there's a difficulty for people and why the recount might be different in some of the Democratic strong areas is that where the Buchanan name comes up and is right next to Gore, it's Gore whose line looks strange, not Bush's.
Mm. Well, in any case, we've used our time. I want to say thanks to Rick Kaplan.
My pleasure.
For dropping by.
I'll be back again
in spring?
Next quarter.
All right. We'll see you then.